Episode 96. First really cold breaths of the season. Welcome, little snowflakes. It's your turn to sparkle. Greetings and welcome into the Patuxet General. I am your host, Jess. This week we continue with last week's leftovers, so I hope you still have that cranberry juice, because I've got something to say about cranberries, and also a historic and local way to preserve meat, pemmican. Not to mention the continuation of The Murders in the Rue Morgue by Edgar Allan Poe. But first, I must thank our Patreon subscribers. These heroes are the horseback riding, flying, train riding, bad guy fighting, magic wielding folks who come just in the nick of time, without whom we would still be tied to the train tracks. Phew! For just a small monthly donation, these folks receive special content, gifts, and advance notice to events, not to mention ad-free episodes. So thank you. If you would like to participate in our holiday promotion by making a one-time donation or become a Patreon subscriber yourself, you could simply follow the links in the show notes or find our page on patreon.com or the promotion on our Facebook page. And thank you. But first, I've got that treat I promised you last week, Pecan Divinity. This week's special holiday treat comes from my own grandmother's collection. It was common during the mid-century for companies wanting to increase sales to put out a cookbook, small pamphlets filled with recipes using their products. My grandmother collected these recipe booklets and tweaked the ones she liked with annotations along the side. One such well-used pamphlet was Grandma's old-fashioned molasses recipes, and today we'll be making Pecan Divinity from it, a chewy, nutty homemade candy. For this recipe, you will need 3 cups granulated sugar, 2/3 of a cup of water, 2 egg whites, 1/2 cup molasses, 1/2 cup shelled chopped pecans. They say this is the candy that never fails. Cook the sugar, water, and molasses very slowly until it forms a little firm ball in cold water, 240 degrees Fahrenheit on a candy thermometer, which I suggest you use. This stage is reached about 8 minutes after the mixture boils all over the top. Remove the pan from the burner while testing. Pour slowly in a fine stream into the well-beaten egg whites, beating consistently. Continue beating until mixture thickens and is cool. Turn into a well-buttered pan, 6x10. Sprinkle with pecans and cut into squares. The divinity sets in about 15 minutes. Enjoy. Long before people came here in boats, the local Native American tribes knew and used the valuable resource that is the cranberry. This special plant, which propagates like a strawberry and with seeds, grew wild in bogs, near the ocean, and along the shore. High in vitamin C, their vibrant color used for dye and astringent properties made this berry valuable and treasured, so much so that they were often used as gifts. It took a while for colonists to understand the value until, as NationalGeographic.com says, in all likelihood, the American cranberry was completely new to the European settlers, who came mostly from southern England. Certainly, there are cranberries in Great Britain, so the colonists may have had a frame of reference for it, says Stephen Cole, author of The Cranberry, Hard Work and Holiday Sauce. The cranberry that became the cultivated cranberry that's harvested and eaten today is distinctive to North America, though. The colonists had a few names for the cranberry. Craneberries, for the way the flower, produced in early June before the fruit grows, resemble the head and bill of a sandhill crane. Fenberries, for the fens, an antiquated word for bogs where cranberries grow. Bearberries, for the bears that were apparently often seen snacking on them. In 1622, the British brought honeybees to North America, changing the way the colonists could use the fruit. Once there was a consistent form of sweetening, says Cole, the cranberry takes off. It gets used as a slightly tart side dish and ends up in pies and tarts. Soon, it's featured on the tables of high society. William Tudor, a satirist and well-known figure among Boston society in the early 19th century, wrote mockingly of cranberry sauce that it is eaten with almost every species of roast meat, particularly the white meats, turkeys, and etc. Some even eat it with boiled fish, and I knew one person, otherwise a very worthy man, who eats it with lobsters for supper. There are independently owned cranberry farms across the northern United States and southern Canada, and some American Indian tribes have kept their connection to the berry. An organic cranberry farm in Oregon, Coquiel Cranberries, is owned and operated by the members of the Coquiel tribe, and each year, on the second Tuesday of October, the Wampanoag celebrate Cranberry Day on Martha's Vineyard. As far as the story of record on cranberries, NewJersey.gov has this to say. The history of cranberries is older than the recorded history of America. The natives called the red berries Sassanish and also Packinminton. The pilgrims gave this fruit the name craneberry. Over the years, the name has been shortened to cranberry. The New Jersey Pinelands, one of the few places where cranberries grow naturally. Cranberries grow on vines, which are very close to the ground. They need sandy, acidic soil, which has a high water table. This wet area is called a bog. In New Jersey, cranberry farming began in 1835 in a bog near Burr's Mill in Burlington County. Many other bogs were soon constructed. Some of New Jersey's first cranberry farms are still operated by descendants of the original owners. Harvesting in those days was a long, hard job requiring many workers who gathered berries by hand. Later, large wooden scoops were used. Since the 1960s, the wet picking method has been used. First, the bogs are flooded. Then a machine with a large water wheel is driven through the bogs. This knocks the berries off the vines and they float on the water. The floating berries are pushed to one side of the bog, where a conveyor belt lifts them onto a truck. Next, the berries are taken to the sorting house where they are cleaned and sorted. And finally, they are shipped to a processing plant where they are made into many cranberry products we enjoy, such as cranberry sauce. Actually, it was a cranberry farmer who made the first cranberry sauce in New Jersey. In 1917, Elizabeth Lee sold her canned sauce under the name Boggs Sweet. Later, she joined forces with Marcus Uran of Massachusetts, who had started his company in 1912. Together, they formed the company that became known as Ocean Spray. Today, this is the largest cranberry growers organization in the United States. In addition to the original sauce, cranberries are made into relish, jellies, cakes, pies, candy, a variety of juices, and even cranberry ketchup. Every autumn, there is a cranberry festival in Chatsworth, New Jersey. As part of this festival, there are contests for the largest cranberry, cranberry floral designs, and tasty new recipes. This tangy red berry has now become a popular year-round favorite. Pemmican was a staple throughout the Americas, a gift from our Native American hosts. It has regional ingredients, so the recipes varied from area to area, but the basics were the same. Meat, fat, and dried berries in equal parts, then stored in animal pouches. Around here, typical ingredients might include fish, venison, or bear, probably with cranberries. The fat would be fully rendered off of animal meat. Then the fish or venison or bear, whatever you used, would be sliced very thin and dried, then pounded to fluffy shreds. Mix that with pounded dried cranberries and rendered bear fat and shape into little cakes. These were put in skin bags for preserving. Unlike cranberries, though, pemmican has yet to make its way back into the culinary mainstream. There is some contemporary interest in this American staple, mainly from those following the trendy paleo diet. One blogger called pemmican the paleo version of the candy bar, creamy and almost naughty. And among extreme athletes and long-distance hikers, looking for a higher ratio of fat to protein. But for most Americans, chances are that deer meat and cranberry candy mash won't be making an appearance on the Thanksgiving table anytime soon. Unless you are one of the adventurous, constant listeners, think about it and enjoy.
I want to tell you about my friend Mike and his Electromagnetic Pinball Museum and Restoration Arcade. It's an all-inclusive place to relax and share anything related to modern pinball, EM pinball, and arcade games. A group of pinball and arcade fans with an addiction to games of all kinds and Lego too. $10 gets you free play on pinball and arcade games all day. You can find them at 881 Main Street, Pawtucket, Rhode Island, or online at www.electromagneticpinballmuseum.com.
And now the continued reading of The Murders in the Rue Morgue by Edgar Allan Poe.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
We must not judge of the means, said Dupin, by the shell of an examination. The Parisian police, so much extolled for acumen, are cunning, but no more. There is no method in their proceedings, beyond the method of the moment. They make a vast parade of measures, but not unfrequently those are so ill-adapted to the objects proposed as to put us in mind of Monsieur Jourdain calling for his robe de chant pour mieux entendre la musique. Vidocq, for example, was a good guesser and a persevering man, but without educated thought he erred continually by the very intensity of his investigations. He impaired his vision by holding the object too close. He might see perhaps one or two points with the usual clearness, but in doing so he necessarily lost sight of the matter as a whole. Thus there is such a thing as being too profound. Truth is not always in a well. In fact, as regards to the more important knowledge, I do believe that she is invariably superficial. The depth lies in the valleys where we seek her, and not the mountaintops where she is found. The modes and sources of this kind of error are well typified in the contemplation of the heavenly bodies. To look at a star by glances, to view it in a sidelong way, by turning toward the exterior portions of the retina, more susceptible to feeble impressions of light than the interior, is to behold the star directly, is to have the best appreciation of the luster. A luster which glows dim just in proportion as we turn our vision fully upon it. A greater number of rays actually falls upon the eye in the latter case, but in the former there is a more refined capacity for comprehension. By undue profundity we perplex and enfeeble thought, and it is possible to make even Venus herself vanish from the firmament by a scrutiny too sustained, too concentrated, or too direct. As for these murders, let us enter into some examinations for ourselves before we make an opinion respecting them. An inquiry will afford us amusement. I thought this an odd term so applied, but said nothing. And besides, Le Bon once rendered me a service for which I am not ungrateful. We will go to see the premises with our own eyes. I know G, the prefect of police, and shall have no difficulty in obtaining the necessary permission. The permission was obtained, and we proceeded at once to the Rue Morgue. This was one of those miserable thoroughfares which intervene between the Rue Richelieu and the Rue Saint Roch. It was late in the afternoon when we reached it, as this quarter was a great distance from the one which we resided. The house was readily found, for there were still many persons gazing up at the closed shutters, with an objectless curiosity, from the opposite side of the way. It was an ordinary Parisian house, with a gateway on one side which was a glazed watchbox, with a sliding panel in the window, indicating a loge de concierge. Before going in, we walked up the street, turned down an alley, and then, again turning, passed into the rear of the building. DuPont, meanwhile, examining the whole neighborhood, as well as the house, with a minuteness of attention for which I could see no possible object. Retracing our steps, we came again into the front of the building, rang, and having shown our credentials, were admitted by the agents in charge. We went up the stairs into the chamber where the body of Mademoiselle L'Espanaye had been found, and where both the deceased still lay. The disorders of the room had, as usual, been suffered to exist. I saw nothing beyond what had been stated in the Gazette. DuPont scrutinized everything, not excepting the bodies of the victims. We then went into the other rooms, and then into the yard, a gendarme accompanying us throughout. The examination occupied us until dark, when we took our departure. On our way home, my companion stepped in for a moment at the office of one of the daily papers. I have said that the whims of my friend were manifold, and it was his humor now to decline all conversation on the subject of the murder until about noon the next day, and then he asked me suddenly if I had observed anything peculiar at the sign of the atrocity. There was something in his manner of emphasizing the word peculiar, which caused me to shudder, without knowing why. "No, nothing peculiar," I said. "Nothing more, at least, than what we both saw stated in the paper." "The Gazette," he replied, "had not entered, I fear, into the most unusual horror of the thing. But dismiss the idle opinions of this print. It appears to me that the mystery is considered insoluble for the very reason that should cause it be regarded an easy of a solution. I mean for the outer character of its features. The police are confounded by the seeming absence of motive, not the murder itself, but for the atrocity of the murder. They are puzzled, too, by the seeming impossibility of reconciling the voices heard in contention with the facts that no one was discovered upstairs but the assassinated Mademoiselle L'Espanaye, and that there were no means of egress without the notice of the party ascending. The wild disorder of the room, the corpse thrust with the head downward up the chimney, the frightful mutilation of the body of the old lady, these considerations, with those just mentioned, and the ones I need not mention, have sufficed to paralyze the powers by putting completely at fault the boasted acumen of the government agents. They have fallen into the gross but common error of confounding the usual with the abstruse. But it is by these deviations from the plane of the ordinary that reason feels its way, if at all, in its search for the true. In investigations such as we are now pursuing, it should not so much ask what has occurred as what has occurred that has never occurred before. In fact, the faculty with which I shall arrive or have arrived at the solution of this mystery is in the direct ratio of the apparent insolubility in the eyes of the police. I stared at the speaker in mute astonishment. "I am now waiting," continued he, looking at the door of our apartment. "I am now awaiting a person who, although perhaps not the perpetrator of these butcheries, must have been in some measure implicated in their perpetration. Of the worst portion of the crimes committed, it is probable that he is innocent. I hope that I am right by this supposition, for upon it I built my expectation of reading the entire riddle. I look for the man here, in this room, every moment. It is true that he may not arrive. The probability is that he will. Should he come, it will be necessary to detain him. Here are pistols. We both know how to use them when occasion demands their use." I took the pistols, scarcely knowing what I did or believing what I heard, while DuPont went on, very much as if in soliloquy. I have already spoken of his abstract manner at such times. His discourse was addressed to myself, but his voice, although by no means loud, had the intonation which is commonly employed in speaking to someone at a great distance. His eyes, vacant in expression, regarded only the wall. That the voices heard in contention, he said, by the party upon the stairs, were not the voices of the women themselves, were fully proved by the evidence. This relieves us all of doubt upon the question whether the old lady could have first destroyed the daughter and afterward have committed suicide. I speak of this point chiefly for the sake of method, for the strength of Madame L'Espagne would have been utterly unequal to the task of thrusting her daughter's corpse up the chimney as it was found, and the nature of the wounds upon her own person entirely preclude the idea of self-destruction. Murder, then, had been committed by some third party, and the voices of this third party were those heard in contention. Let me now advert not to the whole testimony respecting those voices, but to what was peculiar in that testimony. Did you observe anything peculiar about it? I remarked that, while all the witnesses agreed in supposing the gruff voice was that to be of a Frenchman, there was much disagreement in regard to the shrill, or as the one individual termed it, the harsh voice. That was the evidence itself, said Dupin. But it was not the peculiarity of the evidence. You have observed nothing distinctive, yet there was something to be observed. The witnesses, as you remark, agreed about the gruff voice. They were here unanimous. But in regard to the shrill voice, the peculiarity is, not that they disagreed, but that, while in Italian, an Englishman, a Spaniard, a Hollander, and a Frenchman attempted to describe it, each one spoke of it as if it were a foreigner. Each likens it not to the voice of an individual of any nation with whose language he is conversant, but the converse. The Frenchman supposes it is the voice of a Spaniard, and might have distinguished some words had he been acquainted with the Spanish. The Dutchman maintains that it has to have been of a Frenchman. But we find it stated, not understanding French, this witness having examined through an interpreter. The Englishman thinks it is the voice of a German and does not understand German. The Spaniard is sure that it is an Englishman, but judges by the intonation altogether, as he has no knowledge of the English. The Italian believes it is the voice of a Russian, but has never conversed with a native of Russia. And the second Frenchman differs, moreover, with the first, and is positive that the voice is that of an Italian, but not being cognizant of that tongue, is, like the Spaniard, convinced by the intonation. Now, how strangely unusual must that voice have really been? About such testimony as this could have been elicited, in whose tones even denizens of the five great divisions of Europe could recognize nothing familiar. You will say that it might have been the voice of an Asiatic, of an African. Neither Asiatics or Africans abound in Paris, but without denying the inference, I will now merely call your attention to three points. The voice is termed by one witness, harsh rather than shrill. It is represented by two others to have been quick and unequal. No words, no sounds resembling words, were by any witness mentioned as distinguishable. I know not, continued Dupin, what impression I may have made so far upon your understanding, but I do not hesitate to say that legitimate deductions, even from this portion of the testimony, the portion respecting the gruff and shrill voices, are in themselves sufficient to engender a suspicion which should give direction to all further progress in the investigation of the mystery. And I said legitimate deductions, but my meaning is not thus fully expressed. I design to imply that the deductions are the sole proper ones, and that the suspicion arises inevitably from them as a single result. What the suspicion is, however, I will not say just yet. I merely wish you to bear in mind that with myself it was sufficiently forcible to give a definite form. A certain tendency to my inquiries in the chamber. Thank you for joining us once again today at the Patuxent General. If you would like to reach out with a recipe, question, order, or a local ghost story, our email is jess@patuxentgeneral.com. Please reach out. We can't wait to hear from you, and we'll get back to you as soon as possible. But until then, I'll meet you right back here next time at the Patuxent General. a Something for Posterity production, pre-recorded in Patuxent.